You are listening to Prophet Pearls with Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson, exploring biblical prophecy for yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Welcome to Prophet Pearls Face to Face. This is Keith Johnson along with my friend Nehemiah Gordon. We are now going to call this Prophet Pearls Whatever It Takes. We are together in the land of Israel. I just flew in late last night. You've been here for a few days. Nehemiah, welcome to the land of Israel.
Shalom, Keith. Welcome. I picked you up last night from the airport and outside of Tel Aviv, and we drove into Jerusalem, and I'm just so blessed to be here in the land of the prophets, speaking about the prophets. It's just amazing. I love it.
And we'll set a little context. You have found a place for us. We're calling it the safe house. It's in the basement. Where are we?
We're actually in the second sub-basement of this building, which is built into the side of a mountain. And it's like, we were looking for a place to record. And, here's a place where at least on one side is a mountain. The other side is a valley. And so our hope, at least, is that there won't be too many noise distractions. Jerusalem can be sometimes a very noisy city.
Yeah.
And so, we were trying to look for a quiet place to record.
We looked for a quiet place. Why? Because we were trying to record across the world. I was in one part of the world. You're another part of the world. We were dealing with a number of issues, technology issues, etc. We just released a couple, just the last 24 hours, a little promotional video about what we were willing to do. Whatever it takes. We even got on a Harley Davidson.
He made me drive right on the back of a Harley.
Yeah. So I got to say,
I've never been on a motorcycle.
I just have to say, it really is an interesting process. I've been sick the last few days, and then I got here, and then my luggage didn't make it with me, and so I'm here without my luggage. But I did something, Nehemiah. It was really interesting. I've been traveling a few different places, but one thing I do is I take my Hebrew Bible out and I carry it with me. And it's kind of interesting. My other Bible's in my suitcase. I've got my Hebrew Bible. I'm in the land of the prophets. I'm here with you. We're about to record this section. And I just have to say, I really think your idea, and I got to give you a lot of credit for this, it was your idea that we go ahead and do the Amos 3:3 approach together. Can you tell the people a little bit? I know we've talked about it. Tell them a little bit about that and why this is sort of significant.
Yeah, and we were just actually this morning at my mother's apartment here in Jerusalem, and I was sharing this with her. Amos 3:3, it's a verse that says in the Hebrew, it says, in the common English translation, it's, can two walk together except they be agreed? And people take that to mean, well, I can't walk in faith with another person unless we completely agree. We have the same doctrine, same theology. Otherwise, we can't walk together. And that's not at all what it says. When I said it to my mother in Hebrew, she immediately recognized in the word bilti im noadu, the word moed, which is the appointed time when people come together.
Mm-hmm.
And what it literally means, what it says in Hebrew is, and it says, can two walk together without having met one another?
Mm-hmm.
First, you need to meet each other on common ground, and then you can walk together. And what we've decided to do is meet each other on the common ground of the Word of God and walk together in faith before the Creator of the universe. And what we tried to do, the first number of episodes, we were together sitting next to each other.
Yep, in Charlotte.
At your house in Charlotte. And, it was wonderful. And then you flew off to China, and I was in the United States, and we tried doing this,
You were in a few places, weren't you?
I was in a few places. But I think I was mostly in the U.S. at the time.
Yeah.
I would call you up on Skype over in China, and sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't work. And really, for me, the straw that broke the camel's back was when we had an episode that should have taken an hour to record. It should have, been one easy, thing to do. And instead, we were disconnected seven separate times, which means we had eight files of recording. Mm-hmm. And I believe our editor did a really good job so that people didn't notice that, but they realized something was going on.
Yeah.
And I realized at that point, literally, I would be in the middle of talking, and then I'd say, isn't that amazing, Keith? And there'd be, and I thought Keith was completely flabbergasted by what I said because
I had no idea what you were talking about.
And we were completely disconnected. Yeah. The call had hung up and it didn't even tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And we realized we got to come together. And this is such a blessing because Keith, you had a tour over here with the Biblical Foundations Academy. And I came over here for my ministry, McCore Hebrew Foundation, to work on the Aviv search. And so what we decided to do was to come a few weeks early so that we could record these episodes face to face, sitting next to each other. We're here in this apartment. We have can I tell the people, can I describe it?
Absolutely. Let them know what we're
sitting here at a plastic table, and we've put two towels over the table, like bath towels, to absorb some of the shock. So when I go like this and I'm tapping, you don't hear it in the microphone. Mm. And then we hung yesterday. I was with the person who owns this apartment, and she helped me hang a bed sheet across the wall. This is like a makeshift studio, so absorb some of the sound. And look, we're really high tech. This is a professional operation. But we do have this really fancy microphone that Keith made fun of me. But this is like actually a microphone professionals use.
No, it really is, and actually it works. And I just have to say, I will just start out by saying, I've been sick the last week, and I wasn't 100% sure I was going to be able to convince the airline that I could get here. I flew with LL. And, you know, there's a bunch of stuff right now. Depending on where you've been, they ask you questions about if you've been in certain parts of the country and if you've got a fever and all that sort of thing. And I was able to say that I didn't have a fever, but I did get here. You got me to a pharmacy, Nehemiah, and I slept last night.
You had China-itis. You have China-itis, yeah, don't you? Yeah. I had that when I first got back from China, and you've got that now.
Yeah, this basically what happens is the pollution ends up getting into your system, your blood system. And it actually could be a bit serious, but after that first couple days, I then transitioned to where I'm just dealing with congestion and that sort of thing. Got a chance to get some of the famous Bubby Dina's chicken soup today.
That's my mom.
I am excited
best
to get
chicken
started.
Soup in the world.
We're
going
to get started in 1 Kings 18. I just have to say, we've had Prophet Pro partners who've been very wonderful and patient, but we had to make a huge shift, which is that we had to do everything now in the next couple of weeks. And so I'm going to mention the people that are the partners. I'm going to suggest to them, everyone that's listening, that you would take advantage of bringing your comments to NehemiahsWall.com, BFAInternational.com, and let your comments be right there. For those that didn't send in advance, we really do appreciate everything that you write. And again, I think the last few weeks, Nehemiah, we've been inviting people to make comments, and they have been doing that. So awesome.
Yeah.
We're actually going to be going here. The Sioux Falls group is actually responsible for this week. Our Prophet Pro partners from Sioux Falls, and we're in 1 Kings chapter 18, one of the most wonderful passages. You and I have had some experiences with this passage. Maybe you don't remember. We've done so many things. But we're going to talk about 1 Kings chapter 18, starting in verse 1. And we're going to go back and forth as far as reading. I don't have my English Bible with me, but I do have my computer. I've got my Hebrew Bible. You've got the computer. And, of course, whatever's in your mind and memory. And, of course, we have prepared ahead of time. So let's get started. 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 1. It says, "Now it happened after many days that the word of Yehovah came to Elijah," and then right away it starts in the third year. What third year? What are we talking about here? What's the third year? Third year of who? Third year of what? What does the third year mean, Nehemiah?
So, you know, there was this this drought,
mm-hmm.
and it was a punishment to King Ahab and the kingdom of Israel. And this is the third year of the drought. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
They're in Israel is not a country that has, you know, major rivers. Mm-hmm. Our major river is smaller than some. I'll tell you something. I was over in China, and I literally saw open sewers that were bigger than the Jordan River.
Mm.
And it really puts things in perspective. You know, I drive around the U.S. lately, and I'll come across some river that doesn't even have a name. And it's bigger than the Jordan River. It's like some tributary of a tributary of a tributary of some minor river, and it's bigger than the Jordan. And so imagine, if there's no rain for 3 years, there's not enough water to survive.
Mm-hmm. No rain, you got
problems.
So
this was a really big deal. 3 years of a drought.
Mm-hmm. And so the word comes and says, and that, I think this is nothing small. Go show yourself to your enemy, basically. Go show yourself to the guy that's trying to take your head off. It says, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. Like, when I see that phrase, Nehemiah, I see two things. One, go show yourself to Ahab. That's the bad news.
Mm-hmm.
The good news, I'm about to send rain on the face of the earth. I mean, be Elijah there for a second. I would be Elijah like, well, why don't you just send the rain?
And here I have a little bit of an issue, which is I wouldn't translate it as go show yourself.
Okay.
I would translate it as go appear.
Okay.
And it's the same word that actually we see, for example, and we had a Torah portion mm-hmm. called Vayera, mm-hmm. and he appeared when God appeared to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same word. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it doesn't translate and he showed himself. He appeared. And that might sound like a really subtle difference. In Hebrew, it's the difference between an active verb and a passive verb,
mm-hmm.
or actually a causative verb to show yourself, mm-hmm. and a passive verb to appear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it makes a difference in the sense of the sentence, but it's slightly different. Go appear to Ahab. It's almost like Elijah is, and we have that verse where God says to Moses, he says, "You will be a God to Pharaoh and Aaron will be your prophet."
Mm-hmm.
You will be Elohim to Pharaoh. And you know, so in some instances, the prophet, he represents God and he can appear to people just like God can appear to people mm-hmm. speaking his word.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it says, what does it say in verse 18, verse 2? It says, so Elijah did just that.
Yeah.
He went to show himself, and in the NIV here it says that, to show himself or to appear to Ahab. And then it says, just as a reminder, that the famine was severe. Mm-hmm. It's 3 years. I mean, how much more severe? I mean, in other words, it's repeating the obvious. There's no rain.
Well, it's not necessarily obvious. Maybe they, like in Egypt, had 7 years of store food, you know, food stored. But yeah. But in this case, they didn't.
Yeah.
Well, so they were in trouble after 2 years of drought, they were in trouble.
Mm-hmm. And then comes the verse, and again, I don't know what word you want to deal with here, but I just think I love it anytime you get a chance.
Well, the word of the week, I got that already.
Do you seriously?
But that,
you
really? That's later on.
Okay, awesome, no, awesome, awesome. Well, let me. Can
I'm
I just
all over that. Yeah.
Let me read this 18:3. And Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared Yehovah, it says, greatly. I mean, it's a response here. Here's the man who's over the household. He's fearing Yehovah. And then it goes on. I'm going to read this, and then we can slow down and go back. But I just want to read the next verse. And it says, for when Jezebel... Now, immediately when you see something like this, you're reading. If you just read right now and you don't know before or anything, you're like, well, who is this? For when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of Yehovah, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and with water. So we've got Obadiah, we've got Ahab, we've got Elijah, and now we've got this person, Jezebel. So when we read this, obviously those that haven't read it before wouldn't know, but Jezebel is the wife of Ahab, she's the evil queen, who's not real happy about anybody that's not going to do exactly what she wants them to do. So certainly the servants of Yehovah or the prophets of Yehovah would be on her list of those you'd want to get rid of.
Yeah. So I have some things to say about Obadiah, but I'm going to save that for a little bit later, verse 8.
Okay.
Because that's really where we get this new perspective. But just now to say, Obadiah is Hebrew Ovadyahu, which is means the servant of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the servant of Yehovah, Ovadyahu. Mm-hmm. It's one of these very common structures, which is we call them a compound name. Mm. A compound name is two words that together form a name. Mm-hmm. The first word means servant. You could also translate it slave. Mm-hmm. And Yahu, which is the end form. Whenever Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the name of the Father, appears at the end of a name, it's always Yahu or Yah, as in my name, Nehemiah, Yehoah at the beginning. And he is an interesting name, Obadiahu. He is a servant of Yehovah. So it's ironic. Here we have, or even telling, I would say, we have Jezebel, who also has a compound name, Izebel, which probably, it's not entirely clear, but it probably means man of Zebel. And that might be a Canaanite word that means the mystical sanctuary where the God lives up in heaven. Mm-hmm. That's called Zevul in Canaanite literature. So maybe her father named her after man of Zevel, or possibly it could even be the coast of Zevel, the coast of this holy sanctuary, because she comes from Sidon, which is on the coast of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. In Hebrew, it's immediately obvious that we're dealing here with a pun that means something else to the Hebrews, because Zevel means garbage.
Mm-hmm.
It means one thing in the Canaanite language, a slightly different thing in the Hebrew language, even though they're related languages. So here you have Jezebel, who wants to wipe out the prophets of God, and you have the man whose name is the servant of Yehovah. If I were Jezebel, I would have been suspicious of Obadiah from the very outset.
Exactly.
Like, the guy's name gives him away that he's, you know, she worships her Baal, and here's a guy whose name means servant of Yehovah.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask this question. When you see the phrase, destroy the prophets of Yehovah, don't you want to ask yourself, where else is that talked about? Like, in other words, this phrase that's there, it's just there. And it's almost like, it's just a fact. You know, she's the one who did this. And I'm thinking, but where's that at? Where else is that discussed?
And it actually doesn't say in Hebrew destroyed. It says cut off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know. What's the answer? What you got?
I don't have an answer for it. I don't know where else she actually talks about it. I mean, in other words,
where that incident took place?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is a interesting literary device, you might call it, where it's referring to something that happened in the past, but it's the first time we're hearing about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And it reminds me of when Sipora, the wife of Moshe, of Moses, she takes the situation, and she throws it down in front of him, and she says, you know, a bridegroom because of blood, and therefore they said bride. What? Wait, what?
Where did that exactly?
What's this talking about?
Exactly.
We're missing a part of the story, so we actually don't know what those circumstances were. But it is really interesting here, and we'll get to this more. I'm going to save it for later.
Okay, awesome.
It's really interesting.
Well, I just thought that was something, and this happens a lot in scripture where you'll hear something as a matter of fact. You know, the one who did such and such, and you're like, but where is that at?
Right.
And this is
an example. Where did it come from?
That's the question.
No, but I think the answer is it really happened.
Yeah.
And it was something that was well known in the time that they were writing about this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it didn't need to say, hey, by the way, you know.
Exactly.
And it's interesting, like you'll read this, you know, and this is actually something as an author I struggle with. You know, how much do you want to explain to the author? And mm-hmm. I have an editor, you know her, mm-hmm. Schiffer, brilliant, brilliant woman. And she says, you know, don't talk down to the audience mm-hmm. When you're writing. You know, you don't have to explain the obvious because people will be insulted by that. But then the challenge is to know what's obvious to me may not be obvious to them.
Exactly.
So, you know, if I'm writing and I say, you know, 9/11, when 19 terrorists took down the World Trade Center, like, okay, really? We know what that is. You know, like, mm-hmm. what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I've spoken to young people who actually don't know what it is.
You know what's interesting?
Can you imagine that?
You bring that up, and it's funny because I'm presently in Shanghai right now, and that so many wonderful things that are happening. I know there's people that have questions about what's going on, but so many wonderful things and doors that are opening. But it's really interesting about the people that are there when you think about information that you think that the world knows. Mm-hmm. So you can say, you know, well, like what happened at Tiananmen Square, and
well, oh, they have no idea what that is.
Well, you know this because you've asked,
right?
Yeah, I mean,
in China, so, they don't know.
Many people don't. They don't have an idea. They've controlled that information. And depending on the generation, you know,
right,
again,
that's true as well. Yeah.
Generations, what they know. You talk about the Great Leap Forward, and you talk about the famines, all these different things. Different people knowing it, but this statement clearly, when it says this is something that she did, people wouldn't say, now, what was that? I mean, people knew that that's what she did.
Yeah. So. It's actually, and here I was going to save this till later, but we got to talk about it. It's just important. And it has to do with, you know, we see this whole series of kings of Israel who are sinners and they're worshiping, you know, false gods and idols. But they don't wipe out the prophets of Jehovah. They actually manipulate the prophets of Jehovah.
Exactly.
They set up false prophets who speak in Jehovah's name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I compare this passage to another one we have a few chapters later, which I don't think is in the prophet pearls, but it's one of my favorite passages. I think it's, was it 1 Kings 21 or 22, mm-hmm. where we have Michaihu. He mm-hmm. comes and he's the prophet and he's speaking the word. And there's 400 other prophets who are also prophets of Jehovah in his name, but they're false prophets. This is a different situation here. She's attacking anybody who speaks in Jehovah's name. Mm-hmm. And that's because she's a foreigner. She's a Sidonian. So what the Israelites did, and we'll get to this more, is they practiced something called syncretism.
Mm-hmm.
They would worship Jehovah as if he was the same thing as Baal.
Mm-hmm.
This is a different ballgame, the Sidonian situation. She's coming in and she's as zealous for Baal as we are, or as we should be,
Amen.
For Jehovah. And she wants to wipe out the worship of Jehovah, not just hijack it and co-opt it, but to completely wipe it out and replace it with something not similar but different, but something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important. That's a very subtle distinction between syncretism, where you have two things together and you make mm-hmm. them look like the same,
mm-hmm.
and this situation, which is she wants to replace the faith of Israel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, here's what happens, and I think this phrase is interesting. In 18:5, it says, "Then Ahab said unto Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we will find grass and keep the people alive."
No, they don't care about
the people. I'm trying to help him. It says, maybe we'll keep the people alive. No, it says,
they don't care about the
people.
They'll
keep the horses and the mules alive and not have to kill some of the cattle. Now, did that hit you that way too?
Here's what hit me. And I don't know if you see this in the English, but in the Hebrew, the word for kill the cattle is the same word that appeared about the prophets of Jehovah, where it said off, it says she, hichrit. It's the hefil of karat, to cause to be cut off. So literally, it came, you know, in verse 4, and it came to pass when Jezebel caused the prophets of Jehovah to be cut off. And here in verse 5, he's saying, so that we don't cause the animals to be cut off, or we don't cause to be cut off from the animals. So he was concerned about the animals, but he wasn't concerned about the prophets of Jehovah.
Isn't that
the very same word that he's afraid will happen to the animals is what his wife did to the prophets of Jehovah. That's not an accident.
Yeah.
That's when you read it in Hebrew, it jumps off the page and you're like, oh man, there's irony here.
So then it says, okay, so they divided the land between them to survey it, to check it out.
Yeah.
Ahab went one way and Obadiah went the other. Now, is this Ahab the king? Yeah. Don't Ahab like have someone else he could have do this?
I know, it's surprising. Here's Ahab wandering around the countryside with
looking for grass
with
for
some,
cattle.
With some mules and horses. Like what?
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting.
So here it comes.
That's how lowly they had fallen.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And it says so in verse 7, now as Obadiah was on the way, behold, here he comes. Elijah met him. And it says, and he recognized him and fell on his face and said, is this you, Elijah, my master? And verse 18:8 says, and he said unto him, it is I. Go say to your master, behold, Elijah's here. Now, two things there. First, in 18:7, he says, is that you? Now, let's look in the Hebrew here. Mm-hmm. What does it say in the Hebrew? Elijah, my master.
Yeah, so the word for master is Adoni.
Okay, and then what does he use? What does Elijah use when he says, now go to your master? What does it say?
It says, La Adonecha, to your master.
Mm-hmm. So basically, the words are the same. In other words, he's saying, you know...
Actually, the word for Ahab is a stronger word.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we call the majestic plural,
mm-hmm.
which is can used to be described God or a king.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually, literally, if you want to translate... He says, go to your masters and mm-hmm. say, behold, Elijah. It's not, but there's only one master who's Ahab, but it's the majestic plural. By expressing it with the plural ending, it gives it more majesty, more greatness.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, in a way, he's saying, you know, you're calling me, Adoni, go to your Adonim.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So he says, and he said to him, it is I, go say this to your master, behold, Elijah's here. And he says, what sin have I committed? That you're giving your servant into the hand of Ahab to put me to death. As Yahweh your God lives, we got to stop there. Every time I see this phrase, this phrase as Yahweh lives, you know, I can't help but just stop and again be reminded of how important that phrase is.
It's huge.
It's huge.
It's prophetic.
It's prophetic. It's like, man.
So let me share a few. Actually, can we read the verse and then go back?
Okay, talk about absolutely.
It?
Go ahead. Can you read it there?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. It says, as Yahweh your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master is not sent to search for you. And when they said he is not here, he made that kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you.
Right. And then he goes on. He says, and now you say, go and tell your master, behold Elijah, and it shall come to pass that I will go from you in the spirit of Yehovah will lift you up,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera, et cetera. He's like saying, you know, I'm going to go tell... Well, actually, we got to finish that verse. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. Shall lift you up to where I do not know, and I will come to say to Ahab, and he will not find you, and he will kill me, you know, because mm-hmm. I'm going to go tell him that I found you.
Mm-hmm.
And your servant has feared Yehovah from my youth. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Has it not been told to my master, et cetera? Okay, let's go back here. So this is interesting. And the word that jumps off the page... Well, there's two things that jump off the page in verse 10. One is this phrase, Chai Yehovah, mm-hmm. as Yehovah lives,
mm-hmm.
which, as I started to say, it appears 44 times in the Tanakh, that
mm-hmm.
phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jeremiah 12:16, there's a prophetic instance of it. It's talking about God is speaking to the foreign nations that surround Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, it shall come to pass if they surely learn the ways of my people to swear in my name
mm-hmm.
as Yehovah lives. Chai Yehovah.
Now, when you said Jeremiah, are you talking about Jeremiah 16?
What Jeremiah 12:16.
Oh, 12:16.
Yeah. In my name as Yehovah lives. As they taught my people to swear by Baal, v'nivnu betochami, and they will be built in the midst of my people.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a promise to the nations surrounding Israel. If they will learn to swear in the name of the creator of the universe, Chai Yehovah.
Chai Yehovah.
Chai Yehovah, as Yehovah lives. As they taught my people to swear Chai, and then the name Baal, as mm-hmm. Baal lives, and they'll be built in the midst of Israel. So it's really interesting here. I mean, this is a promise to the nations. It's got nothing to do with me. It's a promise for the nations of the world who aren't descendants of Israel to actually be built in the midst of Israel. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And it has to do with this phrase, Chai Yehovah.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears 44 times. It's a common expression. And there's other verses where God says, you know, as I live, we could talk about that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting to me is what he says here in verse 10. He says, Chai Yehovah Elohecha. As Yehovah, your God lives.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. What do you got to say about that, Keith? I think that could be nothing, but I don't think it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he say, Chai Yehovah Elohei Israel, as Yehovah lives the God of Israel, or Chai Yehovah Elohai, as Yehovah, my God lives, or Chai Yehovah Eloheinu, our God. Why did he say, as Yehovah, your God lives?
Now, I would just say this. One of the things that I think is interesting when I'm reading this is that there's this thing back and forth between Elijah and Obadiah.
Yeah.
So he says to him, Elijah, my master. And then he says to him, behold, your Adoni, like you said, the plural. Then it comes back to him and he says, okay, what son have I committed that you're giving? As Yehovah, your God lives. He's proclaiming, and it's like he's saying, he knows the commitment that Elijah has to Yehovah. Maybe Elijah doesn't know the.
But what do you mean? He says later on, you know, it was told to you what I did. I saved the prophets of Yehovah.
Yeah.
So he's assuming Elijah does know, and if he doesn't know, he's telling him. But you know, one of those situations. But for example, I want to bring you a couple of examples here of what I'm talking about. This kind of like emphasizes, this is really strange. He says, you know, your God. Mm-hmm. So we have three places in the Tanakh out of the 44 where it says, as Yehovah Elohei Israel, the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
1 Samuel 25:34, 1 Kings 17:1, and 1 Kings 17:12. Three times, three witnesses where people speak, you know, use this phrase, as Yehovah lives,
mm-hmm.
and they say, as Yehovah, the God of Israel lives. They give him that title. And all of a sudden he says, as Yehovah, your God lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a hypothesis. It's a theory.
Uh-oh.
I can't prove it, but I have a suspicion. Here's what we know. Jezebel was a Sidonian princess. She was a foreigner. She was zealous for the worship of Baal.
Mm-hmm.
She came with a whole entourage of people from Sidon when she married the king of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually the daughter of a ruler of Sidon, a man named Et Baal, which means with Baal.
With
the Aleph Tav of Baal.
Yes.
With Baal. And she brings these people with her. And maybe one of those, this is my suggestion, could have been a man named Ovad Baal. And he comes to Israel as a young man. And he starts to worship Yehovah, and his name is changed to Ovadyahu, Obadiah.
You're really going to come up with that theory, Nehemiah?
It's possible.
You're not going to give me a verse. You're not going
to
say that.
Here's where it comes to me. Verse 12.
Now we're talking.
He says, "And your servant has feared Yehovah from my youth."
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Now that could mean, look, I've done it all my life since I was a baby. But from my youth also might mean, look, ever since I came from Sidon with the princess, I've been zealous for your God,
yeah.
And that fits with him saying, as Yehovah, your God. Look, I've been built into the midst of your people. He knows Jeremiah 12:16, or he knows the concept of Jeremiah 12:16, that if he learns to swear as Yehovah lives, as the way they have learned to swear as Yehovah, as Baal lives, meaning the way Israel learned from the Gentiles, then he has the opportunity built in the midst of the people.
You've come so far. I've known you for how long? How long have I known you? How long have I known you?
I don't know, 13 years? 13, 14
years or something like that. And the one thing you used to always say is, okay, you know, I used to get frustrated about this. I used to get upset about this. I used to want to strangle you, put my arms around your neck.
He's never done it, though.
No, I've never done it.
Thank you, Lord.
And I'd say, you know, I'm thinking, one of the things, and you'd say, yeah, but where does it say it in Scripture? Where does it say it in Scripture?
Well, so I'm not saying this is the doctrine we must accept.
Okay.
And those who don't adhere to this doctrine
exactly.
shall be cast into the lake of fire, and we will not walk together because we are not agreed. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying here
trying to put the pieces together.
I'm trying to put the pieces together, and especially we have this very unusual thing, as Yehovah, your God lives.
Mm.
It's unique in the Tanakh. Now, we do have other places where people say, your God, and especially you'll find that as a phrase that appears commonly in Deuteronomy,
mm-hmm.
where Moses is speaking to Israel, and he says, your God. Well, we could have said our God. All right. But here it's really strange.
I wish we could find an example where his name was changed from...
don't know that. Look, maybe he was called Obadiah and he was born in a little village in Galilee. I don't know. But it's possible, since he's part of this whole world of Ahab and Jezebel, we do know Jezebel came from Sidon, and she brought an entourage with her, and they were trying to stamp out the prophets of Yehovah. And this actually fits another piece of evidence. How does it come about that Obadiah has the opportunity to save all these prophets of Yehovah 50 in a cave? Maybe he was the one sent to kill them. And you know that makes a lot of sense, especially when he's called Asher al Abayit, that who's over the house. So now we have to explain to people what that means.
Yeah.
Historically, he was over the house. He's not the butler. He's what we would call today the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a king of Israel and a queen, and the king, look, the king isn't involved in every decision. He's not interested in the small petty affairs of state. You know, he's going to make the policy and guide things, but he is somebody who makes the day-to-day decisions, and that's the prime minister. And in biblical Hebrew, that's he who is over the house. This is the number two guy in the kingdom. And it's very possible that Who is Jezebel going to trust as the number two guy in the kingdom? One of her cronies from back in Sidon. I'm suggesting this is a possibility. Yeah. It's not a doctrine.
Well, you're opening,
you can completely reject it if you want.
I'm going to reject it, but I want
it's
to tell
entirely
you, I
fine.
Thank you that you opened up the
but
door.
But the fact that he says, as Yehovah, your God lives. So we say in Hebrew, Ze Omer Darsheni. It says, investigate me.
it's calling for it.
And it's begging me to investigate it. And, you know.
Well, I want to say something. It's interesting you said you brought about that being the prime minister, because you've got us in a place, Nehemiah, that's really not far. I can look out the window and the Knesset is not far from here. This morning, early this morning.
In fact, you look out the window, we see the Israel Museum, and the next hill over is the Knesset.
So I walked over and I looked at the Knesset, and then I walked over to Netanyahu's house.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I did. I walked over to Netanyahu's house. He wasn't there.
That's right.
He wasn't there because he's on his way to the United States. Now, I've got to say something about this. You brought about the issue of the prime minister, and I just think it's really interesting, the politics of Israel. And, you know, you've got the king, and now you just brought a really interesting concept that Obadiah is not like, he's the servant, meaning he's the guy that is like way down the list.
In general, when it talks about the cupbearer, it's not just the guy who holds the the cup for
he's
the
got
king.
Some authority.
He's actually a minister of state, you know, and I think we could maybe look to, you know, some modern countries. Let's take the easiest example, which is a little out of date, but the United Kingdom or England. Mm. So they've got a Queen of England. She doesn't have any power anymore, but there was a time when the King of England had power, but he still didn't run the day-to-day affairs of the state. Mm-hmm. He had a prime minister, and under the prime minister there were, you know, there was the minister of the minister of, you know, education and the minister whatever there was, I don't know, back then. And so the point here is in ancient times you had a king. And under the king was he who was over the house, the head of all the ministers. And underneath him was the cupbearer, and underneath, you know, and the head baker. But he wasn't actually just a baker. He was maybe over the finances of the palace, and maybe even over the entire kingdom. So we have these terms that they've lost their meaning in modern English. Mm-hmm. And so this guy who's over the house, he's not sweeping the floors, even though he's running around with the donkeys.
It's interesting, though, because the reason I said that, I think that there's something to what you're saying is that, so I said, what's the king doing out walking around?
Right.
And, you know, it's like not like the king and the lowest guy in the totem pole.
No, these the two guys, top guys. That's how desperate they are.
That's what I think is really a significant. And like I mentioned the thing about Netanyahu. Of course,
what's going on with Netanyahu?
No, so he's on his way to the United States. He's defied Washington. He's going to be speaking to Congress there. I went over to see if I could get a hold of him before he went. He left. He's on his way. I was met with a guard with a gun. the Knesset is here, but also Nehemiah. And we're going to talk about this just a little bit, about the significance of the what Obadiah actually did in terms of saving the prophets. You know, this happens to be a week during – there's going to be Purim. It's going to be celebrated. And for people that don't know, I mean, I really think it's a really interesting thing for people to look into. We can talk about it a little bit more. But I just think it's so interesting we're here right now.
Yeah.
We're actually here at a time – as I was talking to your mother, Bubby Dean is my consultant, folks, when it comes to the politics of Israel and the United States. She talked about the significance of what's happening in terms of what could happen with Israel. And I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk about this with Jezebel and what happens with Elijah. But I mean, I don't know why. I could read this story, and for some reason, it just feels more like I understand the significance of it. I mean, politics of what's going on in the United States and what's going on here and Iran and all of this stuff and Purim.
I think this really ties in.
It really,
I want to go back to Obadiah, who, according to my hypothesis, was born a Gentile in Sidon. As a servant of Baal, and he was brought over, and from his youth he feared Jehovah. And I think, in my opinion, he is a picture in this story of the Gentile who has joined himself to Jehovah.
Amen.
And he stands in contrast to the Israelites who are part of the people of Jehovah, and they're sitting on the fence worshiping both gods. And to me, that is this there's this contrast. We, you know, and Obadiah, I think, is a real, I think it's interesting that he's contrasted. There's two top figures who are looking for the water. And who does this messenger of Jehovah who comes to Jehovah as an, you know, from Jehovah as an Elohim, you know, to appear. It's a word that applies to a God appearing. Mm-hmm. He's there to appear. He does not appear to the Jew, to Ahab. He appears to the Gentile who has joined the people of Israel and embraced the God of Israel, to Ovadyahu, to Obadiah. And I think that's really significant. I think it's at the one time saying, look, here's a hope for the Gentiles, and at the same time, a criticism for Israel. You know, get off the fence and you know, embrace the God of Israel. Aren't you ashamed that God sends his prophet and he's got to go appear to the Gentiles because you're not ready to accept him?
Wow. I will tell you something. We talk about exploring biblical prophecy yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Yeah. And it will be hard for me for these couple weeks that we're here in Nehemiah, as we're going through these sections, to always ask the question, so this is what happened then, but how does it relate to now? And I think right now we are in a really, really, and I don't use the word interesting, I say crucial time in the world as far as Israel and what's happening around the world. I mean, it's sobering to me to come here and to be at this land right now, to read these kinds of stories and to say we're not so far off, and we're going to read many more like it,
yeah,
where there's so much that's going on right in our midst.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, let's go on. But the one thing I just want to emphasize is that we're dealing. Well, let's go on. We got to get through the story.
Yeah, we do.
Say we don't have enough time at the end.
Yeah.
We got to do this.
What verse are we in now?
Verse 14.
Okay, verse 14. Verse 14. And now you are saying, go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. He then will kill me. Elijah said, as Yehovah of hosts lives. And then again, we get this phrase, this swearing, you know, this calling, you know, as a witness and putting it all on the line. Hi, Yehovah, in verse 15, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. And so Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went
What does Elijah mean, who I stood before him? That's really interesting.
Okay, go ahead.
So one possibility is something we've talked about before. Jeremiah speaks about this. He's challenging the false prophets, and the false prophets are speaking in the name of Yehovah based on a vision they had or something, or some kind of spirit that's come and spoken to them. And Jeremiah says the true prophets have stood in the council of Yehovah in the heavenly court.
Yes.
And I believe Elijah here is saying, look, I have stood before Yehovah. You know, I was standing, and there he was sitting on his throne, and he was surrounded by the angels and speaking. I mean, this is a vision, image we've seen before, a picture, and I think this is alluding to that. I've stood before him. It's a very, very specific phrase.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question. Yeah. In yours, do you see this is this in the past or is it the present? Because it's interesting in the NAS, what they say is, as Yehovah of hosts lives, before whom I stand.
Oh no, it's in the past tense.
But then when
I'm looking
in Hebrew, it says it's
the perfect
in the past.
Or past tense. Yeah,
it's something who I stood. Yeah,
yeah.
So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. And then comes this phrase.
Yeah.
Sometimes I want to call you this phrase. No, I'm telling you. He says, and let's slow down and break this open. It says, when Ahab saw Elijah, he says unto him, is this you, you troubler of Israel? Do you like that phrase? I mean, what do you say that phrase?
I think it's ironic that Ahab is calling that to Elijah, because where do we get that phrase? We get it from Joshua chapter 7, 24 to 25, and again in 1 Chronicles 2, 7, where it's speaking about this man named Achan, which is then they make a pun on his name, Achan, because it sounds like Achar, which is troubler. And then when Achan is, you know, he's the guy who stole the gold from Jericho, and they lost the battle because of it, and it's discovered, and he's called Ochel Yisrael, the troubler of Israel. And that exact phrase appears in 1 Chronicles 2, 7.
Absolutely.
Ochel Yisrael, the troubler of Israel.
Yep.
And referring to this person, you know, who's the bad guy. And here the king, who is a bad guy, is calling Elijah, who's the good guy, Ochel Yisrael. And that's, you know, those who call white black and black white, those who call bitter sweet and sweet bitter. You know, those who say left is right and right is left. You know, the people who are evil and do bad, they don't say, hey, I'm a bad guy. Some of them do. But then there's a certain type of bad person who says, no, I'm righteous. What I'm doing is good. And you're the bad person.
Mm-hmm.
In Ahab's eyes, he's great. He's the best thing since, you know, sliced bread.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. What does 18:18 say? Is it basically Elijah comes back and he says, I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house.
Look, and I'll be honest with you. So I recently, you know, in my ministry, Makor Hebrew Foundation, I recently put out this this teaching about the name of Yehovah, and looking at some of the connections possibly between the pronunciation of that name and the name of the Roman god Jupiter. And I won't go into that. It's a whole discussion. But I've had people who have basically written back to me, oh, troubler of Israel.
Exactly.
You're causing trouble in our congregation because you're teaching this to people. And I've literally had people who say, we can see that we agree with what you're saying, but this is just too much trouble. This is going to cause division. We cannot teach this. And I feel like I'm Elijah being called Ochel Yisrael, the troubler of Israel.
Yeah.
And you know, and look, I mean,
I think it's burning up deep inside
me. I've got to speak the truth. Yeah,
that's where I think that's where the good troubler of Israel phrase comes from. When in fact, if you're being called a troubler because of bringing forth truth, giving people access to the information, and you know, I want to stop for a second because you know, we are here, Nehemiah, and I know for for people. There's so many people that appreciate the work that's been done through you know, the ministry that you've been a part, of and what I'm doing. But you know, it really is not something that's easy. It's not something just, you know. And again, I don't want to overly dramatize it, but to actually even physically to be here right now is not an easy process.
Well, so, your flight here was free, right?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, I went to LL and said, listen, I'm about to teach the word.
Look, I've got some important ministry. Give me a free ticket. How'd that work out for you?
Hey, I want to tell you something. It's really funny. Yeah. One of the things that I people always have this sort of shocking view of me. Mm-hmm. When I'm waiting in line, you got to go through security. And this actually happened. This happened twice. I want to just bring people up to date. So I'm waiting to get to on the plane from Hong Kong to here.
Where and your I had suitcase to go through a second. Is.
Yeah, and my suitcase is presently in Hong Kong. Worth all my underwear. By the way, do you still have?
No, I gave the underwear back. I do not have your underwear.
One of the things that I do, so though I to try to calm things down, I'll speak in Hebrew. I'll say a phrase in Hebrew or something like that. And every time they'll say to me, well, why are you learning Hebrew? Here's this brown-skinned, bald-headed guy who's speaking Hebrew, and they're looking at me like, are you trying to learn it for some other reason? And I would bring my Bible out. I bring my Hebrew Bible, and I say, I want to understand this book, the most important book.
Wow.
And you know, this has been
my... Do they understand that?
No, they absolutely... Listen, I got to just tell you this. Yeah. I got to stop. And I get into conversations with them, and they're like, so you're from the United States, but you want to learn Hebrew to understand this book that we know to be, you know, the Word of God. And that happened both in Hong Kong and when I got here, because they asked me a question. They said, who are you here to see? And I made a mistake. I said, Nehemiah Gordon. You mean that troubler of Israel?
No, they didn't say that today. I've known him for Gordon Airport.
No, but I went to explain to them. They said, well, how have you known him? How long have you known him? When did you meet him? And it's all around this. Nehemiah, it's all around this. And I just have to tell you, it was a witness. When I say this, I say it carefully, a witnessing tool and a chance to just talk about the significance of the Word of God. And so BFA International, inspiring people to build a biblical foundation for their faith. I'm not only wanting to do that for me, obviously, personally, and what we do corporately, but I just think that there's just a great opportunity with the Word of God to continue to bring it forward. And I've appreciated the fact that you, and that's why I was so hard on you, you've always said, we got to find it in here. You know, we've got to find it in here. And there's some things that we can't find. There's some things that we are not able to come up with an answer, and we do try to come up with different theories. But what I appreciate you saying is, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, look, I disagree with you on the whole Obadiah thing. I mean, I'm thinking this is a guy who's been there, and you know, he's who knows, he's been brought in to assist. And I still don't know how he could be in the kingdom, and she's trying to get rid of the prophets, and he's there saving. I mean,
he's hiding
so
them,
maybe you're right. There's got to be something
of course
there.
I'm right. All right, let's go on.
Yeah. Anyway,
troubler of Israel.
Yeah, you troubler of Israel.
Can I just say one last thing about that?
Yeah.
You know, as I was reading this about the phrase troubler of Israel, I was reminded of a phrase that appears in the Talmud, which is the sinner of Israel. There's this really mysterious figure in the Talmud called the sinner of Israel.
Yeah.
And my father had a theory about who was a rabbi, blessed memory, about the sinner of Israel, that he was a certain historical figure that lived 2,000 years ago.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting that... At least according to some rabbis, that sinner of Israel was, you know, that particular person. And here we have the troubler of Israel. And do they even realize what they were saying?
Mm.
Yeah. Let's go on.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Okay. So it says here, this is the challenge. This is the love. I love this. This is getting ready to be where we get to the nitty gritty.
Yeah.
For he says, now then send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel.
Yeah.
Together with 450. He knows the number.
Yeah.
Prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah. Who eat at Jezebel's table. That's 850 false prophets. I mean, what kind of a... I mean, you know...
And they're not just false prophets. They're prophets of a foreign deity.
Absolutely.
Not just one deity.
Absolutely.
So I just want to give people a quick rundown on Asherah.
Yes.
We hear about her a lot in the Bible. Not that much. And there's a lot of people who will confuse Asherah with Ishtar or Ashtoreth, which were two different Canaanite goddesses. Ashtoreth... Or Ishtar, Easter, was one of the wives of Baal. Mm-hmm. Asherah, from the best evidence we have from Canaanite sources, was the mother of Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Asherah was actually one of the wives of the Most High God, creator of heaven and earth. This is what the Canaanites believed. And his son, one of his sons, was Baal. So here we have this image of the mother and the son, which is an image that you have like Isis and Horus in Egypt. This is kind of a universal theme in many cultures. But we've got Asherah. And the classical structure that we see in the Tanakh that it's speaking against is they would have the altar to Baal, and there would be a tree or a pole next to the altar, which was the tree of Asherah. And they would be juxtaposed one next to another. And there's even a verse that says, do not plant an Asherah next to the altar of Yehovah.
And we've got
to
and
that's exactly what Israel did. You know, when it says under every leafy tree, that wasn't, it wasn't just there for shade. That leafy tree was the tree of Asherah, the sacred tree.
Isn't it? And then we won't go into great detail about this, but one of the things that caught my attention is just that, you know, Jezebel being a Sidonian. And what the Sidonians were, what were they well known for? What was their number one thing that they were well known about? What could they
commerce
do?
Commerce.
Commerce, but what else did they do that the Sidonians
they
did?
They made purple dye.
No, what else, Nehemiah?
I don't know, those are the two things that come
to mind. They dealt with the tree. They were great craftsmen of the tree. They would cut the tree. This is what Solomon came with to get the Sidonians.
Right, well, because Lebanon's known for its was known for its giant trees.
Yeah, and what did they do with those trees?
They'd use them for rafters in the buildings and the temples.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, but the main things they were known actually was for is making purple dye. And that's why the Greeks called the Sidonians Phoenicians. Phoenicia means the land of purple. But they didn't call themselves Phoenicians. They called themselves actually Canaanites.
Yeah, they were the Canaanites.
They were Canaanites.
So it says here, he tells the people, let's have this, let's have this deal, let's go get your 850 people. Ahab sent a message amongst all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. The sons of Israel and the prophets.
And the prophets need to choose, or the people of Israel need to choose.
Yeah. So we know the story. We're going to get into this. Elijah came near all the people and said, how long will you hesitate? And again, we got to go to the Hebrew here, because in the English...
Wait, I don't even know what your English says.
I'm at verse 20.
Hold on, verse 20.
So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel, brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate? Between two opinions. If Yehovah is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. Come on now.
Wow, so let's go to that verse. What translation was that?
That was the NASB.
Okay, let's look at the let's just look at a few translations on my computer here. So, and the word hesitate is what I'm I mean, that's the word of the week, but it doesn't say hesitate. And I was actually I was thinking, like, what's he reading?
Yeah, exactly.
That, oh, that's their translation of 1 Kings 18:21. Yes. So the NIV has, how long will you waver between two opinions? JPS, Jewish Publication Society, say, how long will you keep hopping between two opinions?
I'm so glad you're going to use this as the word of the week. You're going to do it, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, this has got to be the word.
And it's appropriate because we're, we're you know, based on the Aviv search, we were probably a few weeks away from Passover, about a month from Passover, which in Hebrew is called Pesach. Pesach comes from the word in Exodus chapter 12, where it says, for the plague of the firstborn, that Yehovah would pass over he would pass over the houses of the Israelites and not smite the firstborn there, and that's the word Pesach. He would pass over, and how we have the festival of Passover, and the word here literally is, how long will you pass over the two branches? If Yehovah is God, go after him, and if Baal is God, go after him. So they're and actually it could also be translated as it is in the JPS, to hop back and forth, because when you think about it, when you hop, you have, you're passing from one position to another. You're popping popping around back and forth. And Yehovah popped over, hopped over the houses of the Israelites. And how do we know that? What's the connection? So the Hebrew word for lame, meaning somebody who has a bad leg, can walk, but he's got a bum leg, that's called piseach. Which is a hopper. Somebody who hops around, doesn't literally maybe hop around, but he hobbles. So that's the connection there. And then later we'll have this word. I guess we'll bring it now. So later when they're performing their ritual, this is in verse 26. Can I jump in?
Yeah, 26? Go ahead. It's important.
It says, and they took this is the false prophets of Baal and Asherah, it says, and they, or the prophets of Baal, it says, and they took the bull, which he had given them, and they made it, or they did it, and they called in the name of Baal from the morning until the afternoon, saying, answer us, Baal. And there was no voice and none, no answer. And it says, Vayefaschu, and they passovered the altar which he made. And that's interesting in itself. So they hopped back and forth. And one explanation of verse 26 is that they were actually performing a dance.
Yes.
That they were dancing around, maybe doing something like, you know, instead of a rain dance, a fire dance for fire to come down from heaven, that they were hopping back and forth around the altar, hoping that it would cause, you know, the God to answer them. But it's literally, and they passovered upon the altar which he made, who the he is, we'll get to that later if we have time. But we have, and so this is not an accident that it has the word Passover there. This is alluding back to, in verse 26, it's alluding back to verse 21, where he's accusing them. He's saying, look, you know, you guys are hopping back and forth between the two different temples. Mm-hmm. Which branch are you going to be on? Are you going to be the branch of the tree of Jehovah, mm-hmm. or this other branch from this other tree? Which one are you going to do? And this is of course, I mean, one of the most famous verses of the Bible. You mm-hmm. know, get off the fence. Which one are you? There's actually a friend of mine, Jessica Kay, who's this wonderful singer who actually sings Hebrew songs with the name of Jehovah. She has a song about this, mm-hmm. about you know, jumping back between the two branches, and you know, if Jehovah is God, go after him, and if Baal, go after him. People have written songs about this. You can listen to that on YouTube. So the word of the week is Pesach. The, you know, every word in Hebrew we've said before has a three-letter root, and here the three-letter root is Pe Samachet, mm-hmm. and Pe Samachet is the exact same root as Pesach, as Passover, mm-hmm. as the holiday. But here it means to hop back and forth.
Mm-hmm. JPS, you know, got it right. I have to tell you, when I first got a chance to look at this verse a couple of years ago and saw that word, I thought a lot about sort of the practical position where people do this thing where they change from position to position, from thing to thing. We used to talk about from my heritage, they talked about church hopping. You know, this is the theology of the week right now. This group right here has got it right. No, well, no, they're wrong. Now let's go to the next one. I used to watch a movie called The Wizard of Oz. I don't know if you knew about The Wizard of Oz. They had horses of many colors. The colors would change.
Oh, I don't remember.
So depending on the horse color is red. Now it's green. Now it's yellow. But on a more serious note, one of the things that I think that he's saying that's so important is to ask this question: is Jehovah God? If Jehovah is God, then follow him. There's no sense of having to change any position. There's no going from place to place. But if not, do this other thing. How long will you say he is? He isn't. He is in all through history, all through Israel's history. You keep seeing this cycle. Okay, Jehovah, you are God. Okay, but now we're going to go and do this.
Well, but I do think there's a difference, and I want to contrast what Elijah's dealing with versus, for example, Jeremiah 28 mm-hmm. and 1 Kings 22. In Jeremiah 28, we have Jeremiah facing Hananiah, the false prophet, mm-hmm. and Hananiah claims to be speaking in the name of Jehovah. Mm-hmm. So there it's not, well, if Jehovah is God, don't listen to Hananiah. Well, no, wait a minute. Hananiah claims to believe in Jehovah too and be speaking for him. So there, it gets more complicated. But in the time of Elijah, we no longer are dealing with syncretism. That's where you put the two things together. Mm. We're dealing with this Sidonian cultural imperialism where they're trying to impose their religion upon us.
Yes.
And the people are saying, wow, I mean, this is the religion, the faith of the queen. Mm-hmm. You know, the queen is the most respectable woman in the entire nation. She's not only a queen; she's the daughter of a queen of a great country of Sidon, which is a great world country. Mm-hmm. And so they see this, and they're challenged by it. And he's saying, "Look, stop being challenged by it. Make a choice. Mm-hmm. If you believe Baal is God, then go worship him. Mm-hmm. And if you believe Jehovah is God, then you don't need Baal."
Amen. You know, it's really interesting. I just came back from a place where there's a lot of I was in Africa in Namibia, and there's a lot of what they call what do you call it?
I don't know.
What's the word that they use? Like a voodoo and things like that, where people
folk
have
religion.
These different things. So you're talking about the hopping, and it says, and they were cutting themselves, and they were, you know, we're going to get to this in just a second, but just this idea that there's this emotional, physical action that's taking place to kind of like, you know, build it up. In the end, there is no God but Jehovah, mm-hmm. but yet these people were willing to do all these things, and we're going to talk about it in just a second.
Yeah.
But it says here, he tells them, give us two oxen, and he lets them choose.
Yeah.
You guys go ahead and take the choice. In other words, it's not going to be a matter of which oxen it is. Go ahead and pick whichever one you want.
Well, it's like you pick a card, any card. Like
pick a card, any
I'm
card.
Not going to pick the card because then you'll accuse me of palming it
exactly.
and putting my card in.
Exactly.
You choose the ox, mm-hmm. and so you can't say, oh, well, he had the better ox. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you chose the ox. Mm-hmm.
So put the fire under it, and I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood, and I will not put fire under it. And this is added mm-hmm. the wood under it. But then this is a little peeve that I have. This one little small thing I want to bring up. And this is an English issue, but I want you to challenge me on this. So why is it that we say, oh, let me read the verse first. 18:24. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, is what it says in English, capital L-O-R-D. Okay. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people said, that is a good idea. Now, let's back up for a second. This is, you're going to think I'm going to address one thing. I'm going to address something different. 18:24. It says, you call upon the name of your God, your Elohe, your Elohim.
Yeah.
And I will call upon the name, and we always use the name of.
Okay.
We always say the name of. Yeah. It's the name of, name. In other words, in English, of the Lord makes sense. But when we say the name Yehovah, why do we add the of? This is good. I don't know why this is a pet peeve. It's my pet peeve. You call upon the name of the Lord of.
I'm not sure I understand what you're
but here's what it
what's
says.
The issue?
So no, I'm telling you my little pet peeve. You call upon the name of Yehovah, or you call upon the name Yehovah? Upon the name Yehovah.
I think in English you have to say of.
I don't think you have to say of. It's an argument I'm going to make.
And then in Hebrew what we have going on here is what we call smichut.
Smichut.
Or the construct.
Exactly.
You have two nouns juxtaposed. And so in English when we translate smichut, we translate it as of.
Okay.
For example, an example of smichut or construct is B'nai Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you could translate it, I guess, in English as children Israel, but really it's the children of Israel.
Let me ask you a question, though. Yeah. So let's just say this.
Ruach Elohim, the spirit of God.
If I said to you, if I put this word.
The word of isn't there.
Okay, if I put the name Elijah, Shem yeah. Elijah, what would you say? You'd call the name Elijah.
Right.
You wouldn't say the name of Elijah. You wouldn't. It's this. I'm folks. I'm sorry. I've been
English,
up all night.
I think you would.
I don't think you would.
I think you would do in the name, comma, quotation marks, Elijah, close quotation marks, or you'd say the name of Elijah.
Yeah, name of Elijah.
I think so.
I just don't think you would. Anyway, it's a little pet peeve. That
I arrest
like
you in the name of the law. Right? No,
true.
Right. So yeah. You do say that. I mean, or maybe that's archaic.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right. Well, look.
I'm not an English expert.
But there's another thing that we're going to get to that this is.
But your point is they're not just doing it in God's name.
That's what I want.
They're actually calling his name.
They're calling his name.
Right.
Calling
and so here's
name.
The point I would have focused on.
Yeah.
When it says to call, it literally says bishem in the name
yeah.
of your God. And it says ekra bishem Yehovah. I will call in the name of Yehovah.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you could even translate in there as through, meaning I'm going to speak that name.
Ah, come on.
That's how I'm going to call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but there's no question that this means to actually speak that name. And look what they did. They didn't say, oh, God of the Sidonians. No, they said, Haba'al.
Haba'al,
Anenu.
Answer us. Amen.
Oh, Ba'al, answer us.
Yes.
Isn't that great?
Yes, yeah.
What
is.
A great line in verse 26.
But then, now here's where I think this mm-hmm. is the funny thing. This is some from some years ago. I'm going to challenge you again on this. It came about at noon. Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a God.
Yeah.
And then here it comes. Here's in English now. Either he's occupied or gone aside or is on a journey or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened. Okay, I'm going to throw you a softball, Nehemiah.
Yeah.
What's this phrase? He's gone aside or he's occupied or he's on a journey. What's the phrase? What do you think? Where does the phrase come from?
Yeah.
What's it really saying in practicality?
I mean, you're. What are you asking?
I'm handing you the softball. What's this phrase here? When Elijah's coming and he's saying, Elijah mocked them. He's mocking them. Be Elijah for a second.
Look, he's in the toilet. That's what, is that what you want me to say?
Does it say that, Nehemiah?
That's apparently what it means.
what phrase are you using here?
Look, I'm not going there.
You're just not going to do
it. I'm not going to do it.
Okay.
But I do think it's significant. Look, in the Israelite mentality, the idea that God is frail and mm-hmm. limited like a human being is just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like to the point where literally he's making fun of them. But the Canaanites believed their gods had needs and desires just like people. You know, they ate and they got drunk and they slept. And one of the examples that comes to mind for me is, you know, when I studied archaeology, we learned the story of of Utnapishtim, who you know that more commonly as the story of Gilgamesh, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Babylonian flood story. And it tells in the Babylonian flood story, why did the gods destroy the earth with a flood? Because the humans were making too much noise and it bothered them. It distracted them. So they had to get rid of the humans.
Mm-hmm.
The true God is omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient. He's everywhere, all-powerful and all-knowing. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't sleep. He can't be distracted by a conversation. You know, and I say that because one of those words there, siach, means he's in a conversation or,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
he's off in the bushes. God, he's all, you know, he's everything. He's all places, everywhere, all knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the Canaanite, God is just ridiculous. It doesn't matter how much power and what kind of show you put on with your dancing around and you're cutting yourselves. No, look, think about it. They're cutting themselves. They're showing incredible faith. Let's give them credit for that. Mm-hmm. Think about how much faith it takes for you to take a knife, especially back then when they didn't have tetanus shots. And I'm not joking about that. You could die from a simple cut. So they took a knife and they'd cut themselves and shed blood to show, look, we love you. How much do we love you, Baal? I love you this much. And they'd cut in their own flesh, causing themselves to bleed. And rather than being impressed, Elijah's looking at this and he's saying, this is ridiculous. You guys believe in a God who sleeps? You guys believe in a God who eats and drinks and gets drunk? And no, God's not like that. He's not bothered by noise. He's not distracted. Mm-hmm. That's just not how it works. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how much faith you show in your God, you still have a ridiculous religion. Mm-hmm. And it's a faith based on lies. And so it doesn't matter that you have great faith in the lie. It's still a lie.
That's why I think that Elijah is doing something that's so interesting, that he basically is going to them and he's saying, and let me just use the English here since you don't want to go too far. He's basically saying, this is how you see your God.
Yeah.
Speak with a louder voice. Maybe he can't hear it. Maybe he's occupied or he's gone aside. Maybe he's on a journey. He's busy. He can't be everywhere at one time. Or perhaps he's asleep and he can't understand all things. Our Father, our God in heaven, doesn't sleep nor does he slumber.
Amen.
You know, but basically Elijah comes at him from that perspective and he's saying, look, this is who your God is. Maybe this is who your God is. He's this, he's this, he's this, he's this, he's this. So what do? They cry with a louder voice. And they cut themselves even more.
Yeah.
And they do this until blood gushes out. And when midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, it says. No one answered and no one paid attention. I don't know. This three verses, it's like Elijah is going right at the core. This is what you believe? Okay, where is this God that you believe? Maybe these are the things that happen. He's busy. He's working. You know, I mean, I just think it's phenomenal the way that he hits them right at the core of how they see their God is.
Right. And despite all that, and look, so in a way, like this is actually really significant. Like there's this theological battle going on.
Yes.
In a way, the Canaanites are saying, look, our God's more real. He's like us. Mm-hmm. He feels like us. Mm-hmm. He bleeds like us. He sleeps like us. He goes through these human frail experiences mm-hmm. like we do. Mm-hmm. Your God, he's some invisible fantasy that you have in your head. Mm-hmm. This is how the Canaanites saw the Israelites. Mm-hmm. And so he's saying, oh yeah, your God is so much like you. Let's see him do something.
Mm-hmm.
What can
mm-hmm.
he do?
Mm-hmm.
If he's so much like us, let him show himself. Let him show his power. And in the end, he's just an idea in their heads. Mm-hmm. They have an idea of him being like this frail human, but he's not real. Mm-hmm. And it's only the God of Israel who can do anything. I want to make a little side point about the cutting themselves. And I've got this study on my website, nehemiahswall.com, about shaving. There's this passage in Leviticus, which you know the rabbis will tell you, well, you're allowed to shave, but only with an electric razor, not like a sharp razor. You know, straight razor or a Gillette. And it goes back to this verse that talks about Canaanite mourning practices, that they would, mm-hmm. when they were sad, they would cut themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a ritual cutting. And what's interesting is that these are Sidonians. The significance of, you know, I called them Canaanites. They actually, in their own literature, mm-hmm. refer to themselves as Canaanites. What's significant about it is the Israelites pretty much conquered the Canaanites and drove them out of Israel, except in Lebanon. Lebanon was this mountain range, which was very difficult to get to, and it just wasn't possible to conquer them. You couldn't move armies through there. For the Israelites, it wasn't practical. And so they left the Canaanites there. And really, throughout history, the Canaanites were never fully driven out or conquered from Lebanon. And to this very day, there's Canaanites in Lebanon who are called Shiites, which is a sect of Islam. But the Shiites in Lebanon to this day will mourn over the death of their founder, who was the grandson of Muhammad, a guy named Hussein, the son of Ali. And they literally will cut themselves with swords. You can look it up online and see it. It's called the Ashura ceremony. And they're really distressed. They're sad. When they're cutting themselves, it's not just a ritual. They're sad over the death of this man who they believe was martyred, Hussein. And they're so sad, they show their faith and how deep their faith and commitment is and their sadness by cutting themselves with swords.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this survived in all places, Lebanon, and now it's moved to other places as well because of the spread of Shiism. But to me, that's astounding that this ancient Canaanite practice being described in 1 Kings 18, you can go on YouTube and watch it.
And see it too.
Imagine that. That's incredible.
That's amazing. Well, here's what happens, Nehemiah, and this is a question. This is a question. It says Elijah took 12 stones. You know, basically, it's time of the evening sacrifice. Yeah. Come near to me. All the people came, and he repaired the altar Yehovah. Now it says he took 12 stones.
I'm going
to go back to it. Hold on.
You skipped the last word.
I'm going to get it back to it. Okay. He repaired the altar of Yehovah, which had been torn down.
Yeah.
It says Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of Yehovah has come, saying, Israel shall be your name. Now, the question becomes, where was this altar? When did this altar? Where was who put this? Where does it say to have this this altar to Yehovah that was on Mount Carmel? Where did it come from? Do we have another situation where we're talking about a statement where we don't know where it was?
Well, there's a couple issues here for me. First of all, the altar has been destroyed.
Yes.
It says literally Hehaus, that was destroyed or you have torn down. Mm-hmm. So who destroyed it?
Yeah.
And one suggestion is that actually in verse 26, it was destroyed by these prophets of Baal. Mm-hmm. That it says, and they were hopping around the altar which he made. And usually people understand this to say, well, they made this altar for themselves and they're hopping around their altar. But it doesn't say which they made. It says which he made.
Which he made.
And so some people have suggested, and I'm pretty sure this is the standard Jewish explanation, that they actually, you know, they were doing their dance, and in their dance they intentionally went and trashed his altar.
There it is. Yeah, that's right.
You know, which is very possible. But anyway, it still leaves the question, how is it when the temple is standing in Jerusalem and that Elijah has an altar on Mount Carmel? Mm-hmm. And this goes back it's a complicated question.
It's fair to say it's Elijah? In other words, you would say that he is Elijah?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Meaning it doesn't have to be, but I think it is.
Okay.
And many others have said that too, so I'm not the first one. I think that's the standard explanation, actually. But going back to verse 30, so he's repairing the altar of Yehovah. So what is this altar doing on Mount Carmel?
That's what we're trying to
do. How do you have an altar on Mount Carmel at a time when we have an altar in Jerusalem? And if we look at Leviticus 17 and Deuteronomy 12, we're commanded only to bring sacrifices in the place where Jehovah chooses to put his name.
Yes.
And specifically in Leviticus 17, and this is significant because we've got Passover coming up. Mm-hmm. And I'll hear about people who will say, I want to offer my Passover lamb in North Carolina. I want to offer my Passover lamb, you know, in my city, in my village, in my country. And we're told in Deuteronomy 16, specifically in reference to the Passover, it says, you may not offer it in one of your gates. Here, let me read you this verse. This is important in the context. Deuteronomy 16:2, it says, and you will slaughter the Passover to Yehovah your God, etc., in the place that Yehovah will choose to cause his name to dwell there. Etc., etc., and skipping to verse 5, you are not permitted to slaughter the Passover in one of your gates, which Yehovah your God gives you. Mm-hmm. In the book of Deuteronomy, gates often mean cities, because mm-hmm. Each city had a major gate. So, and then they would set up little altars in those gates, and he's saying, nope, no, no altars and no gates. You must not do that. And the point is that, you know, the first Passover actually in Egypt wasn't everybody's house. But mm-hmm. from Deuteronomy 16 on, that would no longer be allowed. It could only be in the one place where Jehovah chose to put his name, which today we call the temple. There was originally the tabernacle, and then it was replaced with the temple in the time of King David. And then from the time of King David on, there was the only place in the world where someone was allowed to bring a sacrifice was to the temple. Now, the rabbis struggled with this question, and specifically they struggled with the question of all these stories about people bringing sacrifices in Bethlehem and at Mitzpah, and they say, what's going on here? We have the altar at, you know, of Shiloh, and they say, well, Shiloh was destroyed, and in that intermediate period where the tabernacle was destroyed before the temple was built, then they were allowed to have high places. And they actually use that word. The high places were permitted, but when the temple was built, then they were not allowed. This is the rabbinical hypothesis, and the high places were not allowed. It still doesn't explain the Elijah story. And so the rabbis pull out their what we call the rabbinical nuclear option, and they say it's Hora'at Sha'ah. He did this at the time because it was necessary for the purpose. And I think they're right. Mm. Meaning, in a sense, he could have said, look, we can't have a confrontation because we got to go to Jerusalem and there's another king there and we'll have to have a war with that king just to be able to have a showdown between the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Yehovah. He could have done that, but then Yehovah would have never had an opportunity to show the people, look, I can do this. I can show you that I'm a real God who has real power. Yes. And so under those circumstances, in a sense, you could say, and I hate to say it, but in a sense, he suspended the laws of the Torah.
And you know, we've talked about this before, where we'll see a situation happen. We'll say, but wait, why did that happen? That's outside of what the Torah says. And we talked about it before. I can't remember right off the top of my head which one it was. But you know, when I look at this, I think, okay, so we could argue all the way up to the point where it's time for God to show up.
Right. And, exactly.
We could argue
If we had this story and God didn't show up and send the fire down, we could legitimately ask, maybe what Elijah did was wrong. It's game over. If what Elijah did is, you know, Yehovah acknowledged it, then it's true. And look, I want to be really careful here. We have the commandment in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2 and 12:32: do not add and do not take away.
Do not take away.
He's not adding or taking away, but under these circumstances, to show the power of God, he is essentially doing something that technically is outside of the Torah. You know, it doesn't dot the I's and cross the T's. And in that respect, you know, what it tells me is Elijah wasn't legalistic.
Well, we were talking. Do you remember?
Can I get an amen for that?
Yeah.
Well, and then the key word for me is the word "and he repaired."
Yeah.
And we did talk about this. That the word "repaired" literally in Hebrew is "healed," and we have the same word used in this ritual context, meaning that there was a sacrifice that was being done, and it was not being done according to the strict commandments of the Torah. Mm-hmm. In 2 Chronicles chapter 30, verse 20. And we have that same word. It says Yehovah healed the Israel, healed Israel's rebelliousness when they're offering this, or that's actually in Hosea 14:5. It says Yehovah heals Israel's rebelliousness when they offer prayer in place of sacrifices. So here we have these different situations where people can fulfill the will of God and the commandments of God, even though it doesn't technically fulfill all of the rules and stipulations and technicalities of the Torah. But now we're in a new situation that the Torah didn't describe. And in this new situation, he's saying, okay, in this situation, I'm going to allow it because it glorifies the name of Yehovah and his power.
But you know, it's something I would like to challenge people to go through this again. And that there's the phrase in 1 Kings 18:31. He says, he took the 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of Yehovah had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. And it's like, this is just there. You know, it's like, you know, and you go to that story and you're like, wow. So what's the connection between that and what's happening with Elijah? Then he goes on, with the stones he built an altar in the name Yehovah, and he built a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. This is going through great detail. And then he said, fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And it's like Elijah's saying, look, I'm going to show. And again, if the argument was none of this ever happened, we could say, well, look, Elijah's just, you know, he's doing his own thing here. He's having his own, he's having his own party. But he's saying, do it a third time. And then the water flowed around the altar. And he also filled the trench with water. And then at the time of the offering of the evening, well, it says the evening sacrifice of the sacrifice, we knew earlier it was going to be in the evening, Elijah the prophet came and said, O Yehovah, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things. Then it says 3 little things in English: at your word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where did it say at your, in other words, here's another example where obviously there's something going on.
Well, he said, I stood before Yehovah.
Exactly.
He got these instructions. This wasn't on his own initiative.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing that's so powerful about the story, is that Yehovah speaking to, I mean, he loves these people so much. Do you get the picture in him yet? 850 prophets of Baal and people that are following the nonsense, and Yehovah goes through all of this for these people? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I read the story and I just think, man, what does this say about his patience, his love, his compassion, and his care for his people?
You know what it tells me is that God is more patient than we are. Because, you know, I really could see people reading this story and with the legalistic mentality that we have, condemning Elijah and saying Elijah was a sinner, he was a false prophet, he built an altar outside of Jerusalem, he sinned against Yehovah, and he's worthy of death, he should not be listened to as a prophet. And if you want to go down that route, you're just missing it. You know, all of that is a bunch of words until the fire comes down and consumes the sacrifice. And I just got to read verse 37. Can
Please
I do
read
that?
37.
He says, Aneni Yehovah, Aneni. I love those words. Mm-hmm. Answer me, Yehovah, answer me. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they said to Baal. They said, Ha Baal Anenu, Ha Baal, answer us. And he says to Yehovah, Aneni Yehovah, Aneni. And then it says, this people will know that you, Yehovah, are God. Ki ata Yehovah Elohim. Mm. And you have turned their hearts back, I guess, to you. A fire of Yehovah fell, literally is what it says, and it consumed the burnt offering and the wood.
So quickly you go past the last part of that verse?
Which part?
What do you mean? You have turned their heart back again. What does that picture say? Give me...
Yehovah had mercy. Yehovah could have just said, you know, you guys want to worship Baal, I'm out of here. You know, who cares about you? Instead, he sent his prophet to turn them back to him. Mm. And he put it in their hearts. He turned their hearts back to him. Mm. That's grace that Yehovah said, look, I love them that much. I can't just, you know, abandon them.
You know, see the picture, though, it says, and he says, and you turn their heart. It's like taking their heart and switching.
Turning it back, yeah.
Turning it backward, you know? It's like physically, you know, he's going to do this thing where he's going to write his Torah on their hearts. I mean, the picture of what he does.
Come on, preach
it's
that.
It's amazing. But then of course, here comes the key. I think it's the key.
Yeah.
Is that then the answer comes. The fire of Yehovah fell and consumed the offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water. And what was Baal's
awesome?
Whole thing?
There's
about
no water
Baal,
left even.
Baal, the big storm god, the big water god, you know, doing all this stuff. And Yehovah comes in, just takes all that gone. It's just gone. You know, we're not even addressing that anymore. He just takes it. And then here comes this phrase. Nehemiah, we were on tour 3 years ago. If you haven't seen the Open Door series, folks, please get a chance. You can go in and watch the Open Door series. There's this section where we talk about Yehovah Hu HaElohim. Yehovah, He is God. And I just think, wow, what a phrase.
Yeah.
You know, what an amazing phrase.
And it's actually a reference back to something in Deuteronomy.
Mm-hmm.
When the Israelite says, Yehovah Hu HaElohim, Yehovah, He is God. That's the literal translation. It references Deuteronomy chapter 4, 35, and then again in 39, where it says in 35, you have shown to know, literally it says, that Ki Yehovah Hu HaElohim, that Yehovah, He is God. It's the same phrase there. And then it says, En od milvado, there is no other besides Him.
Amen.
And then verse 39 jumps ahead, says, and you shall know today, this is in Deuteronomy 4, and you shall turn back your heart. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
We've got, it's a different, slightly different word, but it's the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
That Ki, that Yehovah Hu HaElohim, that Yehovah, He is God. Bashamayim ma'al v'ala'atz mitachat, in heaven above, and in the earth below, En od. There is no other.
When
you say Yehovah is God, there ain't no other. There is no other. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say something really quick about fire from heaven, and people can do this on their own. Go look at three different verses which describe fire coming down from heaven and consuming a sacrifice. One is in the time of Moshe, Leviticus 9:24. Next in the time of David, 1 Chronicles 21:26. Finally, in the time of Solomon, 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 1. In the time of Nehemiah, who I'm named after, Nehemiah in the Bible, there was, according to the second book of Maccabees, I have a study about this called the Ancient Hebrew Sources of Hanukkah, where I talk about in 2 Maccabees, it talks about there was sort of a mini miracle with fire in the time of Nehemiah. But fire didn't come down from heaven, and they were disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but this is what was happened in these biblical times, in the first temple times and before, that in these four instances, fire came down from heaven. And according to some sources, a fifth time with Cain and Abel, I think we talked about that once, but clearly four times explicitly, fire came down from heaven to show that Yehovah has accepted these sacrifices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, also, if people can take a look here, just a quick phrase on Yehovah Hu HaElohim, Deuteronomy 4:35, 4:39. 2 Chronicles 33:13, 1 Kings 18:39, 1 Kings 8:60, where you're using this phrase, and I you know, it's one of these things that I never get used to being able to say it. Yehovah Hu Elohim, Yehovah, He is God, and there is no other. It's an amazing phrase. It's an amazing statement of fact. You know, we're gonna, Nehemiah, we're gonna try our best over the next, how long is it gonna be? 2 weeks. To do something that's gonna take, you know, we need Yehovah to step in for us.
We absolutely do.
And I want to take a minute. We talked a little bit about this today with your mother, and I was really excited, folks. I was sharing with Nehemiah's mother when he uses the word ministry, how sometimes that's been a word that we kind of say, who owns that word? And you did a really phenomenal thing today talking about what the word ministry is. But I think about it as, I always thought about it as the word service. And I was talking to your mother about if she was aware how many people around the world actually are now a part of your ministry. When I say a part of, they're reaping the benefits. They're getting they're getting so much from you. So I wanted to take a moment, because we didn't do this yet, a moment for you to share a little bit about that. I'll share a little bit, and then we can move on. But we really do. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I've actually, you know, it's really fun, something, Nehemiah. We're recording Prophet Pearls, and I was saying I'm going to go to Africa, and I'll be back from Africa, and then we'll be in China. And I just have to say, as I'm sitting here in Israel right now, just how amazing it is. You know, we said that we wanted to inspire people around the world to build a biblical foundation for their faith. And now I'm watching this happen in ways that are just absolutely amazing. People can go to our site, bfainternational.com, on the front page. They can click and go to the blogs where there's a number of updates about what's going on. They can see the preliminary introductory episodes to I don't know how many different series we have. But there are some things that are going to be announced from Israel that I'm very excited about, so I'm going to hold off on that. I mostly just want people to know that right now it's working. People around the world are being inspired, and we're able to do everything that we can to help them be inspired to build a biblical foundation for their faith. So I invite you to go to bfainternational.com. There's a bunch of options of things that you can do, but mostly just to go there and to see what's happening has been humbling. Doors are being opened literally in different parts of the world, and it's just exciting to see God answer our prayer, and the vision is coming to pass.
Hallelujah. Yeah, and what I've been doing is, you know, and I call it ministry, and I want to address this to some of my Jewish brothers and sisters, because they hear that word ministry, and they immediately think, oh, that's a word that we hear Christians use. So ministry means you're a Christian, and not at all. So ministry is actually a concept we have in Hebrew. It's a phrase, lesharet bakodesh, which means to service, to perform service in the holy. And you'll read in biblical scholars speaking about the ministry of Elijah and the ministry of Elisha and the ministry of Moses. And really all it means is to serve Yehovah. And to serve Yehovah in a way that empowers people with information. That's really what my ministry has been about, is empowering people with information. For me, it's not about, you know, I want people to follow me or I want people to listen to me. It's not about that at all. I've been blessed with information, and I want to share that with others so they can be empowered and they can follow Yehovah through the knowledge that they gain and encountering his word in the original Hebrew sources in which he revealed himself. So that's what my ministry, Makor Hebrew Foundation, is about. The Makor is the Hebrew word for source. People call it Maker. I don't understand that. Makor. No.
Maker.
The Maker Foundation. Nehemiah of the Maker Foundation. No, it's Makor Hebrew Foundation, the Hebrew Source Foundation. Get back to the sources. You can go to nehemiahswall.com. And we got some, you know, hundreds of hours of free teachings there and videos and some really, you know, really great stuff. And you know, and... I get emails all the time from people who say, you've changed my life. This is, you know, wonderful stuff. And that really blesses me. It blesses me because really all I wanted to do was what that person doesn't realize is I didn't change his life. He changed his life by accepting the information and taking it, and not just say, oh, well, Nehemiah said it, but going and using the tools that I gave him and helped him develop to go check the information for himself and own it for himself. And that's what changed his life. And yeah, okay, I helped him with that by presenting him with the sources and helping him understand the sources, but ultimately you've got to do it. And I really want to give a thank you out there. You know, over the last year, my ministry has really flourished and been blessed. And it's not because of anything I did. It's because of all you guys have done out there. And I want to thank you for being part of this ministry and blessing me.
Well, here we are. I mean, Nehemiah, this is the first of a whole bunch that we're going to do. We're here at the secret safe house. We're going to try our best if we can stay healthy and stay focused to just continue to share the Prophet Pearls, exploring biblical prophecy for yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Do you have anything else you want to say?
I want to end in prayer.
Absolutely.
Can I do that?
Can you do that?
And I want to pray this prayer of Elijah in 1 Kings 18:37. Anenu Yehovah, Anenu. Answer us, Yehovah. Answer us. Ve'idu ha'am hazeh. And let this people know, ki ata Yehovah ha'elohim. For you, Yehovah, are God, the one and only God. En od, there's none beside you. En milvadcha, there's none but you. Ve'ata Yehovah, turn our hearts back, turn our hearts around towards you, Yehovah. We need you to do this. We ask you to do this. Yehovah, please be with us here in this room, in the side of this mountain, in the city where you have placed your name forever. Yes. Please, Yehovah, let us offer these words to you and come before you and speak words that empower people with information. and so they can come before you and that you can touch their hearts and you can turn their hearts back. And Yehovah, please be with Keith and give him healing as he deals with his China syndrome. And Yehovah, please give us safety here in the land and let the fire of Yehovah come down and consume our hearts so that we can offer ourselves up to you.
Thank you for listening to Prophet Pearls with Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson. For more information, please visit nehemiahswall.com and bfainternational.com.